This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Over a decade ago, Ayanna Byrd and Lori Tharp penned Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. Back then, the book was hailed as an entertaining and concise survey that successfully balances popular appeal with historical accuracy by Publishers Weekly, and the Source magazine applauded their ability to tap into the art and history of how black hair is perceived in America in a way that will no doubt be relevant for generations to come. With the advent of social media networking, the blogosphere, and the ever-expanding black hair care industry, including an explosion of products specifically for natural hair, Ayanna and Lori's book stood the test of time and is now more relevant than ever. I speak with Ayanna and Lori about relaunching their groundbreaking book, some of the little-known history about black hair the book covers, the business of black hair, the recent distasteful attacks on sportscaster Pam Oliver, and how social media has amplified how we see, understand, and talk about black hair in America. Ayanna and Lori, thank you so much for joining me today on the AYG List.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
How did you two come together to pull this book about the history of black hair in America together?
We happened to work together. We were both in the research department freelancing at Vibe magazine in the late 90s, and we were at work one night at around midnight, sort of delirious, loopy, and the guy, Dave Bree, who was the research editor, told us that we had both worked on black hair projects when we were in school, when I was at Barnard as an undergrad and when Lori was getting her master's in journalism at Columbia. And we didn't know that, and we started talking to each other, and we both had professors who originally told us that we didn't even have enough material to do a 20-page term paper. And then when we handed in our papers, they both said, oh, this is amazing, you should do a book. And, you know, we were both like, I just want my diploma, I don't want to do, I'm 20, please, I just want to get out of here.
Right.
And we started talking about that, and maybe it was the delirium of being at work at midnight, but we were like, let's do the book. And so that's how it started.
Yep.
Interesting. So as you said, you know, intellectually folks thought, there isn't enough material for this, you've got to be kidding. And then once you did this work, there was this incredible desire to see more. So what were some of the helpful intellectual and cultural primers that allowed you to establish the foundation for your research?
That's the interesting thing. There really weren't any. I mean, Ayanna and I, seriously, we're not pouting our horns. We're not trying to make ourselves sound more important than we are. But the reality is there really weren't large works of scholarship that we just pulled together and made it easier for people to read. We had to go to original sources for most of our information. We spent a lot of time at the Schomburg, you know, looking at old copies of magazines, finding the original European logs from their journeys to Africa in the 15th century to find out what Africans were doing with their hair in the 1400s. I mean, nobody, there is no book about African hairstyles in the 1400s. You know, you can't just look that up. And there was no, you know, internet easy Googling when we wrote this book for the first time. So we really did pull together. You know, we had to go, like, where are we going to find out what people thought about their hair? What products were people using? You know, the types of derogatory advertising. You know, we literally went in originally to the original sources, and we talked to people who worked in the industry. We talked to hairdressers who'd been doing hair since, you know, the 30s and 40s. We literally went to the original sources as much as we could, and that's what we put together, and that's why Hair Story is such an amazing book.
It really is. It really, and you can tell, I can see it, I can feel it. It's, you've never read anything quite like this work that you guys have pulled together, so thank you so much for being so tenacious. It's funny because when the book first came out, I shared it with my mom, and she gobbled it up, but we also talked about this. Like, if you are black in America, you have had the conversation with your mama and your aunties and your grandma, and this book sparked such interesting conversations within my own family about, I remember as a child going to that particular hairdresser in that particular black neighborhood in Baltimore where they did the press and curl, and your mama did it sometimes, but sometimes she didn't want to do it, and you went to the old school sisters that did it, and it stayed in longer, and they looked at you funny if you came in there and your hair wasn't exactly in place. Like, all of those things that were in the day-to-day lived experience of people and your elders, and passing that information down, which is something we haven't done well as far as codifying it. So thank goodness for Schomburg, thank goodness for the WPA stuff, and thank goodness for you guys pulling this book together. So I just wanted to compliment you on that as well.
Yep.
What did you uncover during your research that surprised you or made you go, so that's where that came from?
I did not realize what an impact the Afro had on the business of black hair. Mm-hmm. Lori was really insistent when we first started working on the book that we had to make sure that we really gave a focus to the business side of black hair. Normally when we talk about things like hair and beauty, it's more cultural or trends or this is how this made me feel, this is how that made me feel. But she really wanted to track the business side, how much money was being made, who was making the money, how the money was being distributed, what it meant for black communities throughout the country because of what was going on economically with black hair. And it just did not occur to me what, I mean, we always think of the Afro as being this sort of revolution in what hair looked like aesthetically and what it was announcing to the world, but it really changed. It revolutionized the entire hair care industry, and I had absolutely no idea. I mean, it makes common sense that people who are making their money off of pressing hair or relaxing hair or doing hair that needed all of these products would suddenly not be making the same amount of money once the Afro came along.
That's right.
And
mm-hmm.
what's really interesting to me is if you look at the natural hair movement that's going on today and how it is such a product, it is such a business force. It's the opposite
it
of
really
the Afro.
Is. What about some of the things where you were like, so that's where that came from?
I think also, I mean, this is also actually, this is also business focused, but I also found this really fascinating. It is about how black people, even before emancipation, were doing hair and making money, that there were a lot of both enslaved blacks and free blacks who did hair, not of black people, but of white people. But that's where the industry started and where a lot of blacks could actually buy themselves out of slavery from doing hair. And a lot of the, you know, some of the first all-black universities and community centers and things were actually funded by black hair money. So when we talk about how influential the black hair care business has been, I mean, since before we tracked such things, if you will, it's incredible that we can, you know, stand in physical institutions and know that this was the house that hair built. That, to me, was amazing. I mean, especially when we were both told, you know, and even our parents and our, you know, people in the industry were even skeptical, like, do you really have enough to say to create a whole book? I mean, it's truly, I mean, the whole point is that black hair is so much more influential than, you know, oh, I'm wearing ponytails today. I mean, it is such a different topic than what people assume, that it's like superficial or cosmetic only. That's one of the things that I just could not admit. I could not overall believe how influential the hair was, and whether it's the money of it or when we go back to the Afro or the natural movement in the 50s and 60s and how just because a group of people decided to wear their hair differently, the airline industry, the United States Armed Forces, they all had to change their policy, their uniform policy, which again sounds insignificant, but it's really not, to have that kind of influence where if we're going to wear our hair like this, you have to change your you have to change your policies to accommodate our hair. That's huge. Yeah. That's
that
really
huge.
Big.
It really is.
And I also learned, and it's funny because it's such a, I mean, it's such a small point, but it's something that people are so mistaken about, and I still see this incorrectly on the internet everywhere, but that Madam C.J. Walker did not invent the hot comb. So
that's
I've
exactly
known
right.
that, you know, since 1990-something when we first started researching the book. But all the years before, I was like, oh, Madam C.J. Walker, she invented the hot comb. A French person invented the hot comb. And
right.
she just really created the technique that, you know, is still used for people who are still using hot combs as opposed to flat irons, like the whole press and curl technique. She came up with that. But
right.
it's such a minor point that I think people still get wrong. If you ask a lot of people who have heard of Madam C.J. Walker, what did she do? Why was she a millionaire? Oh, because she invented the hot comb, when in fact
right.
she didn't.
I was going to say the other thing that we were pretty surprised to find out is that Madam C.J. Walker probably wasn't the first African-American millionaire. That was
yeah.
Annie Turnbull Malone. And
right.
the only reason, and no disrespect to Madam C.J. Walker, I mean, she was a force to be reckoned with. She was an amazing businesswoman. But the reason that she gets all the glory really has to do with, you know, how their lives ended, whereas Annie Turnbull Malone had a, you know, an unfortunate marriage, a bad divorce. The business kind of faltered because of the divorce. You know, people don't have that, like, fond... She didn't die at the height of her fame, if you
right.
will. And unfortunately, her family members haven't been as dedicated as Madam C.J. Walker's have in preserving
her
legacy.
Mm-hmm.
But we, you know, everybody, Madam C.J. Walker, Madam C.J. Walker, but nobody is talking about Annie Turnbull Malone. And she actually, Madam C.J. Walker actually worked for her. So
right.
if she learned anything, she probably learned it from Annie Turnbull Malone, but we don't hear about her as much either. So that was another surprise because, you know, like Ayana was saying, I kind of walked around thinking Madam C.J. Walker first, but, you know, that she was the only one. When in fact, and there was also Sarah Spencer Washington, there were a few
mm-hmm.
women who were making millions doing this amazing work, which was, again, not necessarily inventing new things, but giving women the power and the opportunity to do something besides housework for white people, that they could find and make a living, a good living, servicing black people, making black women feel beautiful. That is pretty revolutionary right there. And when you look at the time that this was happening, it
That's
goes
right.
against everything that we know. You know, you think of all these movies we're seeing today, The Help and all these things where it's like black women and they were all washerwomen or they were doing dishes. Like, I'd love to see a movie that actually talked about all these women who said, no more housework for me. I'm going to be a poor old woman, or I'm going to sell Madam C.J. Walker supplies and have a pretty good life.
Yeah, yeah. And they build institutions, right?
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that their business model, I mean, today we would only be so, I don't want to say lucky, but, I mean, if there were women doing the things that Madam C.J. Walker, Annie Turnbull Malone were doing, I mean, they would be a force to be reckoned.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
I just remember I think the better part of a week sitting in Harriet Cole's office. You know, Harriet Cole, she's the fashion editor at Essence, and you know, she's a media consultant, and she had archives, like book-bound copies of every Essence up until that point. And so I sat in her office, and I just read through, taking notes and doing research for the book, and it was amazing to me when I saw copies of Essence from the late 60s and early 70s, how hair care companies were the ones directly sponsoring, I mean, running ads about scholarship, community scholarships and all of these things where, you know, I learned how much money black hair was putting back into black communities. Well, that all changed. Like, all those ads and all those scholarships disappeared in the 80s when multinational European companies came in and bought up these black hair care companies. They stopped investing the money back in black communities. And, you know, Lori and I talk about that in the book, but for me, actually seeing the disappearance of those ads in magazines like Ebony and Jet and Essence, that, you know, like every find a black household in the 70s that did not have those magazines
That's
coming
right.
into the house every month, and that these major sources of sending kids to college, helping community centers, paying for different programs was just gone, and we haven't really replaced that today because, you know, the big companies are still not black owned.
You know, I wanted to go back to the evolution where you guys actually start in the book with some of the habits that Africans had with regard to their hair before they came to North America and how those conditions under indentured servitude and slavery shifted that, because I really want to give my listeners an idea and understanding, an optic in their minds, so that they can understand the history of black hair and how black people felt about their hair before they came to the quote-unquote New World, and then how that evolved. So I want you guys to take us sort of on a historical journey of that.
Well, this is really what kind of, this was kind of the essence of what we wanted to share with the public, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. there seemed to be such a, you know, we have to quote-unquote fix our hair. I mean, that's the verb we use, as if there's something wrong with it. And we wanted mm-hmm. to find out, did Africans hate their hair before they came here, or was there a different
right.
relationship? We wanted to establish what was that relationship with the hair before they were brought here under such, you know, horrific conditions. And
right.
we found that Africans absolutely did not hate their hair. They loved their hair. Their hair was so significant in their identity. Hair was used to distinguish one family from another. It was used to determine what status in society you had. The more power you had, the more elaborate the hairstyle. Since most men were talking about patriarchal societies, men's
mm-hmm.
hairstyles tended to be even more elaborate than women because they were more powerful. Women would do each other. There's usually one woman in a family or community that was designated as the hairstylist, and you would only let that person style your hair. So you could tell so much about a person just by looking at their hair, what level of society they were in. If a woman was waiting for her husband to come back from war, she wore a particular hairstyle. If a woman was in mourning, she would wear a particular hairstyle, or maybe not do her hair, and that was the only time a woman would not have her hair styled. And the styles, you know, African hair, we all know, takes time to do, and that simply meant that doing hair often turned into a social situation. So it was really a very, you know, the hair was adored, and it was used for adornment. It was used for beauty purposes. And we know that the hair was also thought to be the closest thing to the heavens. So sometimes people assume that the gods would send messages through the hair. So again, this was something that you took such good care of, you loved, you used it for expression. And it's interesting because even today, even after slavery, even after we were told systematically that all parts of ourselves that were African were inferior and ugly, we still see ourselves showing off with our hair. And that's part of the reason we want people to know our history, is because
mm-hmm.
this idea that you can't have straight hair or you can't color your hair, like that's not African. Actually, it is. The idea that you're going to use your hair to show how you feel, to say where you come from. You know, again, if you're in mourning or you're sad, you might braid your hair. But if you're feeling good, let it out. That is all what happened. I mean, that was what the hair meant. And then, of course, when slave catchers brought the Africans to the New World, one of the first things they did was shave their heads. And that was done, for sanitary reasons. But also, it was a great way to make sure nobody knew who anybody was. Because before that, you know, hairstyles, and the Europeans knew this. They knew that hairstyles indicated what tribe you belonged to. They understood that one African might be able to tell something about another one from their hairstyle. So, again, let's make them all anonymous. We don't want anybody to be able to find one another, you know, to connect, or separate everyone. And, of course, when they were brought to as enslaved humans, they were not given any time to do their hair. Of course, they were systematically told that African hair was more like wool. It was classified as fur or wool or something animalistic. It was told to be inferior until we basically believed it and internalized these ideas. And that's where, you know, the group brainwashing, if you will, of the belief system that our hair was somehow inferior, and that until we could make it look like European hair, we were pretty much doomed to, and you know, to be ugly for the rest of our lives. And that was both male and female, and that's something that we really tried to talk about, is that this was not just females who were told that our hair was inferior,
right.
It was males. And we'll see that today we still see people wishing that their hair was straighter or it looked more European, and that's men and women as well. So that's kind of what happened, is this went from adoring our hair to hating our hair or believing our hair was inferior and just a systematic working towards wanting it to look straighter. And that also, it was not just a beauty thing, but this idea of, you know, when people talk about good hair and bad hair, that comes from a system of slavery where those slaves who were lighter, had lighter skin, looser curled hair that looked more European, were obviously favored in the slave system. Those were the slaves that got to work in the house. And everybody always says, well, being a house slave wasn't great. Of course it wasn't great. You were still a slave. But the conditions in which you lived tended to be far superior to those who worked in the fields. And in addition, you had a much more likely chance of being freed if you had curried favor with, you know, the master by being in his house all the time. So there really was a direct advantage to being in the house or being a house slave. So that lighter skin and looser hair translated to a better way of life, and that we still have not gotten rid of, those ideas.
And I think it's not just, you know, the idea, but it's actually the application of it, right? So if we continue on this evolution post-slavery, you talk a lot in the book about the pioneers in the hair care industry for Black people and the fact that they were talking about beautifying, especially Black women in particular, but also about the life that it would afford you if you had your hair kept in a certain way. And we can argue, you know, whether or not this was in alignment with this self-hate or if it was a little bit more practical than that. I mean, you talk about how Booker T. Washington and Nanny Helen Burroughs and Marcus Garvey also talked about this obsession, quote-unquote, with hair is taking away from shaping the mind and the brain and all of the things that we need to do to forward a people. I mean, you talk about how a little bit more complicated it was. Can you talk about that a little bit more in the span of this interview?
I don't remember when Lori went natural. She already was when I met her, but I remember when I stopped relaxing my hair. I was 18, and I was in college. I was in New York, and I was feeling everything that I felt was like the exuberance that only an 18-year-old can. So every thought that I had was like, I felt it so much. And I connected a lot of that passion to my hair when I decided to get rid of my relaxer for what I thought were really practical reasons. I was not trying to make any kind of statement. I was trying to stop paying to go to the salon because I was a broke college student. And I naively thought it wouldn't really be that much deeper until I felt really confused about how different I felt about myself and my identity and walking down the street and all of these different things because I no longer had long straight hair. And I started to have conversations with people and hear these really simplistic ideas of straight hair means that you're self-hating or you want to be white or you think white hair is better. And if you don't have straight hair, it means you're somehow quote-unquote blacker. And neither of those really spoke to my experience. I was the exact same person with the same belief system and the same morals and the same feelings culturally about being black and politically about being black as I had been when I'd had a perm. And so when we were doing this book, it was really important for us not to present these really, what I think of as really oversimplified ways of looking at what it means to have straight hair and what it means not to have straight hair. I think it's almost impossible to say what does it mean because it's such an individual it's such an individual answer for everyone what their hair looks like. I mean, our sort of pie-in-the-sky wish for Hair Story, and we would say this when we were touring with the book when it first came out, was that we would hope that there could be this generation of little kids. Like, we would hope that we would know that we'd done our job a little bit more if by educating people on the history of hair, there could be this generation of little black girls and black boys who could look in the mirror and actually feel good about what they saw back on their head, whatever it looked like. To take away the need for thinking your hair had to look a certain way and that meant you were a certain kind of person. And also for us, for people to be able to see their hair and the way it actually grew out of their head as just as beautiful as the 20 other ways you might decide to do it, whether it was with braids or weave or straight or blah, blah, blah. We, you know, I don't think we've gotten to that place. I think that it's still such a complicated conversation that's been made even more oversimplified by the existence of things like Twitter and social media. where I think people really try to take out the nuances of a lot of really complicated arguments to just present these things. You know, Lori brought up the idea of where good hair and bad hair came from, those quote-unquote definitions of textures of black hair. And, you know, they both were born during slavery, those phrases, but they're still used today. They're used everywhere. And the meaning has not changed at all. But our individual experiences have changed so much from then, and I know that that is part of the conversation that it's important for us either to get through in the book or when people are actually talking about how they feel about their hair or why they could never go natural or why they would never wear a weave or why they would not do all these things that we talk about, that we don't just fall into saying, oh, that's because you hate being black, or oh, that's because you love white people or you love whiteness. And I think we're not going to get past really just these oversimplified ways of looking, of discussing it, if we don't push deeper and just allow people to have their own individual stories. And whatever that story could look a million different ways. It could look like a waist-length weave for somebody. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be at the end of the day everyone has natural hair.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't think we've gotten to a place yet of thinking that there's still really these two camps of thinking that are sort of in opposition to each other when it comes to straight versus natural.
Yeah. It's interesting. I remember when you guys first published this book and I came to your book talk and your book party in Philadelphia. And I think it was at the University of Pennsylvania, Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
At the end, you guys were doing a Q&A, and I think I got in there late. And how was I wearing my hair then? I had a long ponytail. I remember that. And the women gritted on me so hard. And it was funny because I remember at the end a woman asking you a question about who some of your – I think it was Ayana who answered this question.
Oh,
about
I got
who
in trouble.
Your favorite. Yeah, you did. And it was funny because somebody said, well, who are your favorite hair icons? And you said Little Kim. And I thought every woman in that place was going to lose her mind. But the way that you explained it was, like, she has fun with it. It's like an accessory. And I think they just didn't expect that. So part of what I really appreciate.
I think I had, like, waist-length locks at that time.
Yeah, I know.
And so
the optics of that were a little bit jarring for people, I believe. But I thought it was really interesting that you both, as you kind of toured the country and have these conversations on your book talks with people, that you've always said, okay, there's this kind of false dichotomy that we need to trouble a little bit, and that part of this is knowing your history so that you can embrace the freedom to do whatever you want from a place where you understand what it is you're working with and what it is you're doing, right? I think that's the power of the book. I think that's the power of the two of you, regardless of what your hair may look like on one day or the other. I do think it's very important that you have two black women, two women of African descent, who have chosen to do whatever they choose to do with their hair personally, but also who took on this incredible project and did it so well and then came back to it decades later, a decade and a half or so later, to really say, look, this has evolved over time, and it's important that we keep this conversation going. Because honestly, we didn't have social media, we didn't have Twitter, we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have 50 billion blogs where everybody's sort of like the hair care, the black hair care guru, and it's Team Natural or it's Team Weave or whatever it is. And we're also in a space where it seems like almost anything goes with hair, right? So where there were kind of these stringent values of, oh my God, if you had a weave, you fronted like you didn't have a weave and nobody really talked about it. Or mm-hmm. if you were having trouble trying to figure out how to do your hair natural, it was like you had to be in this secret mafia of the natural hair care people where you actually got good information. You didn't have the hair care products that they have. I'm amazed by the number of hair care products that are absolutely dedicated to black women's natural hair. It was unheard
of. At Target,
at
the most mainstream
place
ever.
Target, all of these places. So I'm so glad that you guys kind of came back to this project, because in the time since you've did the book the first time, it's amazing the changes. So I want to talk to you. The book as it was gorgeous and beautiful and amazing, and that's why you're here. But tell me a little bit now about after the first time that you brought it out, you know, how it was received and what you're anticipating and what you're thinking through now as you're about to embark on this new phase of putting out the book again with extra chapters and this new kind of hair economy for black people.
We realize if you read the first book without mm-hmm. the new chapters, I don't think the word internet is not in the book. But that's how
right.
little that it had to do with black hair history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obviously not the case anymore. It's changed things economically. It's changed things as far as the conversations that are being had. I mean, you talked about when the book first came out, it really touched on conversations that you'd had growing up with your family, probably in the kitchen or at hair salons. Now those conversations are happening in the Internet. And we just felt as though our book, to really tell the story of where black hair is today, it had to look at the technological changes that have happened since it first came out. So that was really exciting for us to document. At the same time, I think it's going to make the conversations that we're having when we tour the country that much more interesting, because there are so many more people not just having this conversation in their families, which has always happened, but in these really contested spaces where they either feel like, where you can log on to countless number of blogs and post your opinion and decide how you feel about something, or watch a television show. I mean, just the other night, someone asked me what I thought about Pam Oliver's hair.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know what you're talking. I don't watch football. I said, I've been out all day. I don't know what's going on. What are you talking about? And they sent me, so I Googled and saw that she was being called like Chewbacca and all these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Detestable. Detestable.
It was detestable, and I also decided that I was sleepy and that it was hours after the Twitter rant had started, and I was going to bed, and I was not going to discuss this. So I could do that. Like, I could log off, and that be the end of it for how much I had to think about it on Sunday night. But I think as Lori and I go to tour the country, I'm not going to be able to say, I'm tired. I don't want to talk about this.
That's correct.
I mean, I think it is important to have conversations about the group attack of a woman who was wearing her hair one day on television, or when there's award shows and we see people kind of jumping on this bandwagon to attack or celebrate certain hairstyles, or attacking what children's hair looks like, from the Obama girls to Beyonce's baby to Angelina Jolie's daughter Zahara. I mean, it's everyone fancies themselves an expert because they maybe posted something on their Facebook wall. And I do think we're all experts when it comes to black hair if we've been living our lives with it, but I think it's going to be really interesting for me and Lori to have these conversations with people who are engaged in these conversations about black hair every single day, which was not the case when the book came out before.
I'm going to have to pause because, Lori, I want to get your responses, but I need to get to this Pam Oliver situation because, as you know, I love football. And I was watching. And what was interesting for me, because I'm a Facebooker, I try my very best not to be mean-spirited because I just detest that. What was interesting is I was in a room with a bunch of people from different walks of life, and when Pam Oliver came on the screen, everybody had a gut reaction to what she looked like. Now, I did not understand before that moment that there had been this full-on frontal attack of her. But it does kind of get into the question of what you talked about a little bit before, where people – black folks in the profession had to defend their right to wear their hair in a certain way. And that was a political act on some level. And then sometimes it's just, you know, what are the corporate standards? I have friends who work in corporate America who are black who are like, oh, my God, I would never wear my hair like that because it just would be frowned upon today. So I do think that there was a whole lot of conversation in the social media space about what's acceptable. And does this whole thing detracting away from her ability to be a competent sports journalist, you know, have something to do with what she is or is not doing with her hair? It was a really fascinating conversation.
I think it's, you know, this is social media at its worst. And at the same time, I mean, this is, you know, it goes back to the whole, which is like a big pet peeve of mine, of what happened with Gabrielle
Douglas. Yeah.
Douglas, where we make the point that, you know, we've always talked about people's hair. We've always policed each other's hair. We've always giggled about it, talked about it behind other people's backs, you know, said, oh, look at that, isn't that funny? She looks like this, she looks like that, or what have you. And I really have a problem with what gets blown up as some sort of new negative commentary when, in fact, it's probably the same amount of commentary, but we didn't have the technology of Twitter or, you know, Facebook to amplify it. And
That's
then the
right.
problem is it gets amplified and then it gets picked up by mainstream media outlets. I'm looking at, you know, like Fox News and different places that have picked up the
Pam Oliver wig story. It wasn't a story. It was a bunch of people being like, doesn't her hair look like this or doesn't her hair look like that? That's
right,
not a
right.
story. But then, if enough people go back and forth and it starts to trend on Twitter, suddenly it's a story. And I think that is the benefit of social media has been that people around the country and around the world actually can actually build a community around natural hair or doing something different with their hair, whereas before they might have been the only one in their town and their city who was, trying something new and was looking for some sort of validation that choosing something different, choosing a natural hairstyle, for example, was okay, and even like that they could figure out how to style it. That's the beauty of the new social media as it relates to black hair. But the downside is that we get these voices who, again, I would not believe. I mean, people are always talking trash about other people, but the social media amplifies it, and then the mainstream media picks it up. And it's like mainstream media doesn't understand what is story-worthy and what's just people talking. And I think that in some ways we have to – I don't know what the answer to that is. I don't know if it's the mainstream media, everybody reads Hair Story and gets a clue, or if it's that the mainstream media, finds more things to talk about besides picking up on stupid Twitter trends. But at the same token, they'll also talk about cute cat memes that go around or other stupid stuff as well. But that is the kind of double-sided, the positive and negative of what social media has done to the black hair community in that sense. And I don't think that I do feel bad for Pam Oliver in that she has to live through this. And interestingly, there was an article in the New York Times just this past Sunday in the opinion pages about female journalists in general being attacked for their bodies. That if they write something serious or hard-hitting, that people who are in opposition to what they're saying, will make attacks on their physical bodies, things that male journalists really don't have to deal with. And it makes a lot of women journalists, stand back or stand down or leave the career. And so whether it's hair or body, I think female journalists in general have to deal with this in ways that are completely sexist and unfair. I don't think her career is over. I don't think that just as many of our other women who have been attacked for their hair have moved on. I can't think of anybody who's been like a social media hair joke who left their careers or professions. I think she'll move on because, tomorrow's going to be somebody else's hair or
today it's already
somebody
else, five minutes later it was already, Sherman, we were talking about something else. And I think you guys are right about, I always say to people either, social media, it amplifies your goals or it amplifies your holes. Whoever you are, it's going to show up in social media. So if you're nasty, it's going to show up in social media. All those people who say, oh, my God, I hate Facebook because it's crazy. It's like, no, it's your house online. And so if you let crazy people in your house, that's how it's going to be. And if you're crazy, that's how it's going to be. So anyway, we digress. But thank you for addressing that.
Yeah.
I mentioned something about it on my page, and we got into an interesting conversation about it, and folks were on a lot of different tones. But, my thing is I absolutely detest her being vilified in this way. And I do think that when something is happening with you physically in your career and it is detracting from your excellence, that you have to deal with it. I don't know how she deals with it. I don't know how Fox deals with it, but I thought, oh, my God, this is absolutely horrific for her, because how do you continue to do your job? Because social media is instant. So not only is she getting it, all of her peers are getting it. Everybody in the stadium is getting it. The world is getting it. It's instant. And so that's going to be interesting. I will definitely be tracking you guys and seeing how things are trending as you're doing this. But, for those people who have to impart really important things in society, thinking about the ways in which social media shapes how we communicate and how we connect is a very important part of how you transmit this information. So I really appreciate you guys talking about how you're thinking through some of that and how that's really going to be different from us hanging out in 2001 in the Barnes & Noble.
Right.
Very different. Laura, did you want to make another point about that, the whole second coming of the book and what you're anticipating?
Well, yeah. The thing that I really wanted to just make note of is that the book came out in 2001, and there's an entire generation of young black women who never heard of the book, and we are so excited that they will have a chance to be introduced to it, not reintroduced, but introduced to it, because there are so many women who are excited and curious about their hair, and a lot of it looks just like style. All of the blogs and YouTube channels and stuff like that. So I think that they're going to be really excited to see, you know, to get some more background information about this medium that they have dedicated their lives to talking about 24/7. There is seems to be such a bigger audience now for this information, and we are really excited for people to get it in their hands for the first time. And we are looking to this generation of black women who have, you know, taken to social media to kind of spread the gospel about hair. They're just, you know, there's documentaries being made every day, new YouTube channel, a new blog. And that's actually quite exciting because that tells us that there is an audience, a real audience.
Oh, yeah.
Our agent said that, you know, when the book was actually, when we finally realized that we were going to be able to do an update, she said, you know, your book came out, you know, ahead of its time. People
yes.
weren't necessarily ready for it, and now they're so ready for it, and we're so looking forward to see how it is received by this new generation of women and men who are talking about hair. I mean, really talking about it, and I hope that they, you know, we're giving them something to really, you know, digest and chew and truly have something to talk about as opposed to somebody's wig choice on air.
That's a beautiful way to end this. Two questions for both of you. If you weren't doing the work that you're doing right now with this book and the other writing that you are dedicated to doing, what would you be doing? Who would you be?
I'm sorry. I just love this question.
If you listen to any of my interviews, you knew this question was coming. So, I am sort of a creature of habit. I try to like mix it up a little bit, but this is the question that's always going to be asked.
Oh my gosh! I think if I weren't writing, first of all, I love writing. Like I've been a writer since I was 8, and I got my first typewriter. So, you know, I am a professor, and I you know write magazine articles and nonfiction books. But I think if I wasn't doing this, I would be like Ayana. I wouldn't necessarily be on a beach, but I'd be someplace much warmer, and I'd be writing novels. I would be writing novels, and I'd have a business on the side. I don't know what, but I really want to have my own, like, simple business, like selling cupcakes, except that I don't really like cupcakes. So, like, selling, like, little mini hand pies, you know, something simple that I can just, you know, do in the morning, write my novels and, like, be inspired by the palm trees and mangoes and passion fruit and have my kids around me. Like, that would be my – that's what
wow.
I would be doing otherwise.
Wow. Ayana?
Well, like Lori, my only real skill in life is writing, so I can't imagine a life where I was not a writer. But I would be, I think, in Barcelona, which is my home away from home. And I've been writing children's books lately, picture books, so it's, even though they're super short and I think people think they're really easy, they're really, really hard. So I would be focusing on writing my children's books and being warm. Mainly I would be warm. That's all I can think about right now.
Yeah, as we're all looking at snow. Exactly.
Oh, my God.
Tell everyone how they can find you on social media.
Well, we have a wonderful new website called hairstoryonline.com, all one word, hairstoryonline.com, where we, you know, the thing about Hair Story, you know, we finally got to update the book, and of course the day we handed in our manuscript, like, something else blew up. You know, there's always something happening in the world of black hair, so, you know, rather than saying, like, can we add one more page to the book, we just decided to go online and, you know, track all the new news, opinions, celebrity sightings, and things like that. So Hair Story Online is where people can go to keep up with new Hair Story information, as well as finding out where Ayana and I are going to be on our tour and, you know, radio shows and stuff like that. And we also have a new Facebook fan page, which is Hair Story Relaunch. It's facebook.com/Hair Story Relaunch. So you can like us there and also tune in there to find out where we're going to be, what we're going to be doing, and any updates about the book. And on Twitter, you can find us at Hair Story Online. So those are our official Hair Story places. And then, of course, you can find me on my website, loritharps.com, and Ayana.
Oh, and ayanabird.com. I'm sorry, I thought you had another one, Lori. You can also find me at ayanabird.com.
Okay, great. I am so delighted to have my enduring friends, Ayana Bird and Lori Tharps, on my show today. Their book, Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America, When is it coming out? Wait a minute. When is it coming out? What's the due date?
Officially,
the 28th.
So on the 28th of January, you two can have your own updated version of Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. Two of my favorite writers. One of the things I want my audience to know is how much of a fun read, how much of a quick read, how much of an interesting read, how much of an engaged read, informed read this book is. For anyone who cares about black hair, but anyone who cares about people of color, American history, women, this is such an important slice of history, but also of contextualizing something that everybody kind of talks about no matter what walk of life you are. Everybody is really interested in black hair. We all have our stories. Actually, in another book that Ayana wrote, I wrote about my hair. It was a very big deal. My hair is still a very big deal. Anybody that I know that's black, their hair is a big deal, people. So if you want to get a really good read that's sober and interesting and thoughtful and also in some ways very provocative, but very, very informative, this is your book. Go out and buy it. Share it with other people. Have conversations about it. See them on the road. When you go out on the road and you see them on the road, be polite. Ask great questions and share the goodness with everybody else. Again, ladies, I thank you so much. I know you have so much to do in your day, and I'm so happy that you joined me today. So thank you so much for being on the AYG list, and I will see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, April.
Ayana and Lori were kind enough to offer a free copy of Hair Story to one of my listeners. Please visit the AYG list on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to find the trivia question you must answer to win. Good luck.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.